So I'm standing with Roger Saul at Sharpham Park. Roger, my immediate reaction is to put my hand in there and kind of feel this grain. It's very beautiful. It says something very primitive about it.
Well, it is, and I suppose one of the things is that this would have looked the same 7,000, 8,000 years ago. And the husk you can see on the spelt, you've got two grains in each husk. And it starts out life here on a, depending how good or strong the year is in terms of weather, you can have a very, very long stalk of grain. And then they all break down two by two into this pile of lovely grain. And then once we've got the husk off, which is actually 40% of the weight, which is A, you've got to get it off, and then B, you're only left with 60% of the total. So that's why, probably the main reason why spelt fell out of fashion over the years, because with ever-intensive farming, as you know, we can now get 4 tons an acre from conventional wheat, if not more, with loads of fertilizers and pesticides and insecticides, whereas an organic spelt, we're probably very lucky to get two, and it's probably more likely to be 1.5 tons. And we've got to use that land in between, and we've got to refertilize it. So we'll grow a spelt and then possibly a second spelt in a field. Year three, we'll put in a clover, and the clover will fix the nitrogen in the soil, and that probably goes in for 2 or 3 years. So you've actually got really, let's say, 1 in 3 years of spelt. So if we said 2 tons optimistically, that's 2 tons versus 3 years of wheat is 12 tons. So you're, at a huge disadvantage in terms of your productivity. So dead in the water in terms of commercial farming.
On the other hand, I mean, this is beautifully clean. I mean, it's incredibly beautiful and clean. This is, I mean, there's no marks on it. There's no, it's a beautiful looking wheat.
Yeah.
It's honey coloured, sort of honey and caramel with little sort of wisps of cream in there. I mean, it's a lovely looking product.
It is. It's very tactile. So from the start, we started with packaging, which my aim was when I went to organic farm. I said, okay, well, how do I do everything sustainably? So I got some lovely craft paper bags that were made out of recycled paper. Only problem was the only place I could make them was in Singapore. In fact, China, probably. But so bringing them across the world wasn't very clever. So we then went from that to finding a local paper bag maker, literally 10 miles away. And we took it to him and said, can you make it? And he got recycled paper. And so that journey of finding out how does one do something efficiently, commercially, and yet at the same time arrive on the shelf with a price that does work. Unfortunately, the paper bag here cost about 5 times that it did in China, even shipped in. But the pennies cost still, it was a decision I had to make to do it here rather than over there. And then as time went on, we sort of sophisticated the packaging. Everybody else did craft paper bags, so suddenly we were no longer visible. So we then had for black bags, which sort of set a certain luxury from my mulberry background. Black was always a very, very powerful color in the fashion world. So we did black and then used our wyvern from the coat of arms and concentrated on putting product together that really was tasty. Now, the great thing, which I haven't mentioned already, is that spelt tastes delicious, and that shouldn't really happen. Something that's good for you tastes great, so that combination is good. We found en route as well that here we are in the heart of Somerset near Glastonbury with all its mystic powers, and there was a lake village found here by a Dr. Bullied many years ago, and they dug it out and they checked it, and would you believe, well after I'd started growing our spelt, we found that there were spelt grains from leavened bread in the villages. So spelt has certainly been here and could well have been grown here because we're a bit of high ground off the levels 5,000 years ago. So we know it came in 9,000 years ago, probably a cross between emmergrass and wheat, goat grass and wheat. And so when that really happened, I don't think anybody's quite clear, but it certainly appears that spelt came across from the Middle East, from Mesopotamia and around there, and came in with the merchants and then came up through. But the fact it was here 5,000 years ago is an interesting thought.
It's also interesting that looking at the history of the weather patterns, that certain wheats like rivet and like spelt fell out of fashion as the temperature dropped. And there's certainly some of the things I've read would suggest that the mini ice age was one of the things that saw spelt off.
Yeah, it could well be. Although, interestingly, we've only been growing for 10 years, but we've had some fairly dramatic fluctuations in weather and rain and sun and so on. And it's the most resilient of crops. And it does seem, because we grow it with various farmers across southern England now, and it does seem to grow in very different soils, from chalk to limestone. The one soil it didn't like was peat.
You have quite a bit of that, yes, around here, I must say. Just having driven through, there's an extraordinary amount of peaty soil.
Yeah, no, it likes to get its root into things. The trouble with peat is you just sort of disappear down.
Roger, how far do the roots go down in comparison to a modern grain?
I wouldn't have a clue. All I know is that we started by ploughing and with a heavy clay soil, turning the soil over, and it's very rich. And we then thought we were pulling up a lot of weed and growing organically. We had a huge weed burden each time we ploughed. So we then started doing min-till, which is just doing the top two inches.
You'll disturb it a lot less, and you're going to learn, and the weeds they'll stay dormant.
Yeah, and then I was persuaded again by a farmer, oh, you really got to plough, you're not. And I did it 1 year, and it all came up again, and I'm back to min-till. So, but I think you've got to experiment to go backs and forwards. So my guess is it's really sitting in that top layer. I don't know, but I would have thought modern wheats would be much shallower.
No, you're right there. I just wondered if you'd sort of got a sort of thing underneath that. So, I mean, these bags and things you've got here, you've got clearly now quite a wide range of products. Now, the one I used the other day was the white flower here in this gorgeous sort of tangerine bag. I've got to be truthful, I've never really made a really amazing spelt loaf, and I've been baking spelt so long, I've tried a lot of different ones. And if I showed you the photograph of the one that I made, it was a breathtakingly beautiful loaf. It was actually possibly one of the nicest loaves I've ever made.
Wow.
I was absolutely blown away by it. So that is high endorsement from me, because I'm a bit of a flower obsessive.
Well, so, isn't that fantastic that it's been grown here in England, milled here, stone milled, and you've made an amazing loaf from it. That's the target, if you like.
No, exactly. And I think there's something, we talk about local food. And local doesn't necessarily mean exactly bang on your doorstep. Local sometimes just means that it's been produced in Britain. I mean, that localism now isn't just about who's next door to you. So for me, I thought it was beautiful. The question I was going to ask you is there a history to that beautiful painting on the front?
There really is.
A very romantic.
Yeah. Well, there's a big, and again, one of those weird stories. I was given a book for Christmas about Somerset, and this picture was on the front of the book.
I recognise it now. I'm standing here realising what I'm looking at.
Well, the picture was on the front of the book, and I thought, that's a view of the tour. And of course, you can view the tour, Glastonbury tour, from every north, south, east, west. But it looks like it could be from here. And I went outside the front door and looked, and it was a painting by Richard Wheatley, Richard Wheatley, who would have gone round doing as reverends did, sort of a perambulation doing paintings. And he painted, I think, in about 1840. So it was in Somerset Museum, and I borrowed it from them, and they said I could have the rights to use it because it came from here. And here they are.
Almost looks like we're standing
farmers
here.
Scything through. Yeah, we're just a little bit back, scything through. A very tall crop, which is probably 5 feet tall. Is it wheat, or could it have been spelt? And it could have been spelt. Anyway, romantically, I think it's spelt. So to have found a picture of Sharpham 150, 160 years ago was amazing. We've had lots of little bits like that. Again, like we found that the fact the spelt grain had been grown in Glastonbury 5,000 years ago. Those little bits sort of come as you go on your journey.
Is it possible to go and have a look at the mill itself?
Yes, indeed.
We'll go and head out that way. Just walking into the mill here.
Sam, Vanessa.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, have been around many mills, thousands of mills, hundreds of mills.
Many mills.
Many mills.
part of the job, but they're all different. I think what's very charming here is that Sam is hand packaging every single one of these. And Roger, I'm sorry, they're all being hand packaged, and she's very lovingly sort of tapping them and then folding them over in the most precise way. But I really love the fact that they're hand finished.
I do and I don't. If I was being more efficient, I mean, we do pack it in much more.
I think that's quite romantic myself. perhaps not the most economic way of doing something, but then at the same time, the next time I pick up one of those bags, I'm going to remember that they were made with love and care.
Right, so our miller is up in the north today. So we mill everything here, and we process all of our pearl spelt and our flour, and then off goes our grain to be flaked for muesli or to be turned to bran flakes with the bran. So trying to minimise the journeys around the country. So any warehousing after that, it'll go as close as it can to get to the retailer. So lots of transport, obviously, with relatively low-cost product is crucial to get as effective as you can.
So where are the milling stones themselves? Is it roller milled or is it stone? Where are the actual
Definitely
mills?
Stone milled.
All stone milled, right. And what kind of stones are they and where are they? Are they in here?
You're going to see them in a second.
Ah.
So big bins here that we input. We carry probably up to 1,000 tonnes any one year, and we'll grow about, this year we're going about 500 acres, I think. So we hope to get 1,000 tonnes if it all comes through properly. And then we store that in a giant warehouse with one of our farmers. And then we bring it in here to the mill. So this year we'll grow, of our 500 acres, we'll grow about 75 here on the farm. So if you like, we long surpass what we need that we can get out of our own farm. So we have to start getting more and more farmers to contract for us, supplying them with the seed. So in it comes, through this machine it goes here, which grates off the outside of the husk that we talked about, the 40%. Up it shoots here through sets of pipes and so on, and back into this machine here, which shakes around, and you'll see at the top little bits of stone. Anything heavy will come to the top. The grain gets lighter, goes to the bottom, and then you'll see that there's a stone in there. And then I'll go through again. But basically, that's all the stones come out that in medieval times you'd have had holes in your teeth as you munched away through your bread and stone.
Yes, I don't think that the medievals had a necessarily very good dentistry. No.
For many reasons, probably, let alone the stone in their bread. But here we've got my pearling machine, and that's where we grate off the outside of the grain. Off comes the outside of the bran, and that means that you've got a grain then that is a bit like rice to use, and we use it just like rice. It's fantastic in cooking. It'll go with any meat sauce flavour, and it absorbs it, whereas rice is a hard grain.
It's a spelt
tofu. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so that's a real chef's favourite, and you shouldn't really be able to congeal it, so it's actually good for any of us that are not great cooks to use. Now here you've got, right in the middle of this giant set of Willy Wonka-type machines, you've got, and bins, you've got the actual mill. So in this whole thing, this is the mill. So you've got stones here, round stones, just as they would have been thousands of years ago. In this case, the top stone is fixed and the bottom stone moves around, and literally it grinds the grain in between it.
And is that a French burr stone, or do you know where the stone's from?
I'm not sure where these stones are from, but I think it probably is France, and it's made the same way they would have been made, composite stones.
Very hard stones.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, excellent. And do you, are these the only sets of stones you've used, or have you gone through a few now?
No, this is still the first set, but they have been
covered,
yeah, at some point, I think. So here we can do good old wind up on the side, so you can tighten it for a tighter milling or looser, and off it goes. On from there, the flour comes up through here and then into the sieves. And we can sieve that through all sorts of different very fine mesh sieves, which then can take the bran out so that you can have either whole grain flour or a the white flour you talked about, which made that wonderful loaf of bread.
So how many tons to go through here a day? Do you know roughly what you're...
We do about 20 tons a week.
That's fantastic. So when did you first start? What year did you first 2000, start?
2000. Well, the first year we started was 2004, and there was a small local mill that was a good old-fashioned water-driven mill, and they had a spare set of stones. And I said, well, could you do those for us for Organics Belt? And he said, yes. So that was my first. And I realised we could only do 30 tonnes a year there, so that was going to be a bit restrictive. So I then set out to see whether I could build one. And with all my Mulberry experience of, if you like, the Heath Robinson approach of how did you get around this problem of making handbags and stretchy leather and edge inking and gold foil stamping, we just spent years in Italy and... in Germany for the highly mechanised machines, Italy for the slightly Heath Robinson one out in the home sort of thing, and just learned how to do these things. So it wasn't scary to go out and search the world and say, OK, well, how do I find these things? And I found Scandinavia, there were quite a few companies that made mills for Nigeria or Kenya or somewhere like that, where they needed a good old-fashioned roller mill and didn't want a great big huge... Sorry, stone mill, not a great big huge roller mill. And so there's still that technology, but in its most modern form, existed.
I think that's the thing that struck me. I mean, as you asked me earlier if I'd been to a lot of mills, and I have. And I think that is an ancient process, and it's completely modernised. And you can see that would work. And it is the most modern set of stone ground mills I've ever seen. It's quite nice. It's all sort of cozy in a huge iron enamel home. It's lovely.
Well, as you know, flour mills are the most combustible of places, and probably we've got the biggest vacuum cleaners here in the world. But in a flour mill, when you obviously get flour sitting on surfaces, and if you did get a spark there, you would cause an initial explosion that would give a flash explosion, which would blow up the whole building and everybody in it. So every electric motor is double covered, treble covered sort of thing for safety purposes.
I hang on, I'll just pause this for a second.